Welcome to Ampersound, a podcast brought to you by the team at Visualist. Ampersound features snippets from our interactive digital magazine, Ampersand. Every episode, we speak to multi-hyphenates who have captivated our minds. We ask them about their code switching, routines, and mindsets. For the full stories, check out ampersand-mag.com. That's ampersand-mag.com. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. Today, I'm joined by entrepreneur, design enthusiast, and budding architect, Justin Potts. We discuss the intersection between design and architecture, how his entrepreneurial spirit developed at just 10 years old, and his enormous 3-month road trip across the US. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the stories. Just to start off, I would just love to learn more about your interest in architecture. How did this come about?
Yeah, definitely. So my interest in architecture is a fairly new one, maybe only over the past year and a half probably a year and a half that I got interested in it. But I've always kind of been a student of design and interested in design. And I've also been really interested in kind of this bits and atoms pieces of digital experiences in kind of this real world, whether it's something as small as just like building a website and then getting to use it on your phone in real life, or whether it's something like architecture. I think there's something really energizing about just kind of seeing those things come to life. And architecture was kind of the perfect blend of both of those, where I got to learn more about design and kind of lean into that creative edge, but also lean into a field where you could experience something that kind of exists in kind of this just kind of like philosophical headspace almost of, you know, design's hard to describe, kind of just exists in our minds, but then actually have that interaction with it in the real world, which I think is really interesting.
Mm. So you said it's a recent interest, but like, before that, were you sketching things? Were you drawing things? Like, how did design or creativity come into your life?
Yeah, I think it really kicked off for me when I was in middle school. I grew up in a fairly entrepreneurial family. My dad was running his own software business. And through that, I picked up coding and would work with him on kind of side projects and weekend projects starting when I was in middle school. And at the time when I had just started learning things like databases or APIs or you know, building the back end of these applications, was kind of out of reach for me, given that I barely knew how to code at all. And so I kind of just leaned into the other part, which was, you know, designing what the website would look like or learning how to use various CSS frameworks or building those websites on my own. And so now over the past however long it's been since middle school, I've kind of doubled down on that as what I like doing, where I like to fall into projects. And so, you know, I was mostly doing stuff on the digital side of things and the product design side of things. And then now with this interest in architecture, I started just trying to sketch buildings and figured, you know, if I can look at a website and figure out where the lines go on the website, maybe I can do that on a physical piece of paper. And so I just, you know, found buildings that I thought were inspiring to me or interesting to me, started sketching those. And then, you know, when you start sketching things or actually looking at things with kind of a critical eye, you start noticing things that maybe you hadn't noticed before, or started noticing things that stood out to you more than the rest. And that kind of led me into learning more about, you know, why those columns were there or how people did these interesting things with this, you know, shape of a building here or something. So it all kind of blended together, but started off in that, you know, digital side of things.
Ah, that's interesting. So you are really interested in desert architecture at the moment. Why? Oh, how did that come about?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this one a lot because I don't actually have a great answer to that. I think my kind of interest in architecture really kicked off when I took a trip out to Ojai, California, stayed in a really pretty house there. And Ojai is not really the desert. It's more of, you know, rolling green hills and mountains. But it was a really interesting style of architecture that I stayed in there and ended up visiting Palm Springs with a couple friends later on. And I grew up in a suburb just north of Dallas, Texas, moved around a bunch, you know, San Francisco and now Brooklyn. And so the desert is kind of one environment that I never really had any exposure to. And I think I'm drawn to just kind of the surrealism of the desert. And it's just so different than anything else I've experienced. And there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in architecture there too, right? Palm Springs has it's like the most density of mid-century modern architecture, which has some really interesting history behind it. It's obviously a really great place for desert modernism, where there's this interesting blend of how houses are built to not only, you know, be art on their own, but also adapt to the environment and kind of be a part of it rather than just something sitting on top of it. So I think there's just a lot of interesting lessons to be learned on top of just how pretty I think the area is.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's a very recent interest, but you've explored a lot of that. You've really dived deep into that. Like, what are some of the avenues that you've been using or exploring to learn more about it? And is it all self-taught as well?
Yeah, it's all self-taught. I've just found a lot of value in kind of doubling down on these areas that I'm naturally drawn to, like desert modernism or mid-century modernism. And either, you know, just reading about them on things like Architectural Digest or other magazines, or even just, you know, following those like Instagram accounts that post photos of buildings, and anything I see is something that's particularly interesting or thought-provoking, you know, going and learning more about the architects who designed it, reading what they have to write about it. And so kind of just, you know, starting off really broad, I don't really seek out a ton of material. I kind of just follow wherever my interest takes me, which I've done with a lot of my other interests as well, you know, whether it's entrepreneurship or startups or design or architecture. You know, I'm a big generalist and kind of just like following wherever the trail takes me until I either, you know, get bored of it or find something to do and work on it or things like that.
Mm. So I want to jump in and talk about your background in product and software for a bit before coming back to talking about design and architecture. So let's talk about your interest in product and tech. So you mentioned that in middle school, you were starting to dabble in designing websites. How did that translate into entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so we would build these, you know, apps and websites on the weekends. And I think similar to architecture, I was just really energized by seeing them come to life. One of the first apps that my dad and I built was called IOMonkey, which would sort your grocery list in kind of the optimal way to go around the grocery store, depending on how the grocery store was laid out.
So
you
and your dad were doing that together?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. What a nice father-son bonding activity.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, instead of, you know, going outside and throwing the ball or playing catch or something, we'd be inside working on our laptops. I'm sure my mom hated that. but yeah, I mean, we would build these things that, you know, get to see them be usable. And at the beginning, obviously, it was something that looked like it was built by a middle schooler and his dad. So, you know, it didn't have very far reach outside of, you know, my mom, who used it once before she went to the grocery store or something, I'm sure. And over time, you know, in high school, I just started, you know, dabbling in more things, creating things like a flashcard tool for me and my friends, or, you know, even something as weird as, like, you know, I would like make lemonade and bottle it and put nice little labels on it and just sell. It was like an elevated lemonade stand, I guess. And I would sell that to my friends in high school. And I just, you know, get a lot of energy from seeing people use the things that I build and work on with my friends. And, you know, I think I did that long enough that I just kind of always felt this urge to keep doing it, to keep building something new. So I'm very impatient and wanting to, you know, like leave my job and go start something of my own again, or I'm always hacking on something. I just think it's fun. You know, you can build something that starts with an idea and actually become something usable that other people can enjoy.
Mm, wow. So then that translated into you founding your first rail company in college. Tell me how that led to like co-founding Kite in college and what happened after.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I went to the University of Oklahoma for a little bit. I went there studying management information systems, which was kind of this blend of business and computer science, knowing that I either wanted to go and work in tech or wanted to work in startups. And so kind of just wanted the credentials on both sides. And so we attended this hackathon in Atlanta, and we had 36 hours to build something. and there was an award there for kind of the best solution to online harassment. And so we decided that, you know, obviously online harassment is plaguing these websites that have user generated content, or what, you know, UGC. So this can be anything from like Twitter to Reddit to just forums to messaging channels. And so we decided that the easiest way to combat that would be to build this service that developers or website owners could integrate into their platforms that would automatically be able to detect this kind of abuse or harassment and classify, you know, what kind of abuse or harassment it was, who it was targeted against. And so we built that into this developer API, launched it, piloted with a couple of apps and companies, and we didn't get very far. It's a really hard problem to solve, but it was kind of the first project that I had built that I felt like had a lot of potential that I could see, you know, turning into an actually big company in someday. And so while we were working on it, I ended up leaving OU. I transferred out to a business school in San Francisco, where I got even more exposure to investors and startups. And we ended up shutting that down. I think it was March of 2018, but I was still in the startup world out there. And a little less than a year later, would raise money to go full time on my most recently sold startup, which was Eventify.
Nice. Did you always know, since you were a child, that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
I think I knew that I wanted to work in tech and create things, you know, as early as maybe middle school. I think part of that was just a side effect of being around my dad and his business for so long. I was always kind of exposed to these tech conferences or meetings that he was going to, or kind of his day-to-day. But I don't think I actively considered the idea of, you know, what being a startup founder would be like as kind of a job until later in high school. And even then, I think I was still leaning towards the classic, you know, going to work for Apple or Google or something as the roadmap. But even now, I think, you know, it's interesting to have the drive or the desire to be a startup founder, because I don't think that you can just quit your job and decide that you're going to be a founder someday. I think it's kind of a hammer in search of a nail. And that I think if you want to be a successful founder, or in my experience, the most success I've had as a founder has been when, you know, I'm doing other things that I enjoy. I'm just kind of letting my curiosity run wild until I find something that's worth working on. And then I go and commit to that full time. And so even now, while I work at this new company through our acquisition, you know, I certainly have a desire to start something new and to go and found another company someday. But I don't think I'm in a rush, just because I want to make sure that whatever I choose to spend the next, you know, 4 to 10 years of my life working on is something that I'm really passionate and excited about, and not just the idea of being passionate or excited about something.
So tell me more about your most recent startup, Eventify. How did that come about? Because I know it's financing for college students. Is that right?
Yeah. So we enabled nursing students to pay for school through income share agreements, which meant that they got funding up front in exchange for a percentage of their future income. And then once they graduated and earned more than $30,000 a year, they would just start making payments as a percentage of their income. And those payments would pause if they lost their job or became unemployed. And so we saw it as a really safe and affordable and flexible solution, especially compared to traditional private loans today. And we also saw it as a much more accessible solution. We didn't require a credit score or a cosigner. We'd underwrite it based on their academic performance and future earning potential. And then on top of that, we tried really hard to build a brand around being invested in these students and not being like the other kind of more corporate or predatory lenders that we see on the market today. And it really started in 2018 when my co-founder and I saw the rise of income share agreements at coding boot camps like Lambda School. And it was frustrating to us that, you know, as recent students, that this option wasn't available for us or our peers. We had friends that had worked 4 jobs to pay their way through school. And so we saw how debilitating the private student loan industry could be to our peers. We thought the easiest way to bring income share agreements or ISAs to the masses was to build that infrastructure for the schools to manage these programs themselves, just like coding boot camps did for their income share agreement programs. So we raised a little bit of money for it. We actually moved into an RV and we set off on this 10,000 mile road trip around the US where we literally went and knocked on doors of financial aid departments with our pitch deck, asking them kind of what they thought of the idea and if they were interested in using it. We very quickly learned that it was difficult to sell financial software to financial aid departments when you're a young looking 20-year-old living out of an RV driving across the country. We also learned that if we were to sell to a school, it would take much longer than the 4 months of runway that we had in our bank account to actually get the solution up and running and make money. And so we took a step back and thought about kind of what it is we're actually trying to solve and what our core competencies were. And we figured out that, you know, the real problem we wanted to solve was just that students needed access to funding. And we thought one of our core competencies or unique advantage that we had was this insight from this young person's perspective and our ability to build a brand around being student focused. And so in mid-2019, we launched our direct-to-consumer product where students could actually apply directly for funding from Avinify. And then on the back end, we allowed investors to buy shares in students' future income. So we're kind of this marketplace model that enabled investors to bet on that earning potential and fund students more accessibly.
So I want to rewind back to the RV part of things. Whose idea was it? And like, what was the thinking behind living out of an RV?
Yeah, when we had started the idea of raising money to go full time on this, my co-founder Timo was still in school at the time. I was at another job, and you know, we were just kind of looking at like what apartment rent would even be, and how much money we'd have to raise to support ourselves, you know, actually living in one place. And we were thinking like, wow, that sounds, you know, really expensive, and especially if we signed a 12-year lease, that's really long term. We also started thinking about kind of the sales strategy to schools. And because we had or were anticipating such limited runway or time to figure things out, we didn't want to take any risks that our cold emails wouldn't work or that they wouldn't pick up the phone, and decided that if there was any risk of them not responding to our email, then we should just show up in person. And, you know, he and I had also kind of talked about this idea of, you know, just like living in a van more broadly, as you know, what these people are doing with their converted Sprinter vans or just traveling around to these different national parks. And so now we are kind of faced with this opportunity where, you know, we have no job other than the ones that we've given ourselves. We have just a little bit of money to do something with. And we're also in this position where we're going to be talking with potential clients all around the US, and decided to be a fun opportunity to do that. So we started in San Francisco. We had a vague idea of, you know, we knew that we'd spend 3 months on the road and we'd do kind of a loop around the US. Wow. And from there, then we just kind of started driving and stopped where we wanted and talked to schools in between.
Wow. What were some of the most memorable parts of that long RV trip?
Yeah, I think we obviously got to see a lot of different sides of the US. We, you know, went through Southern California, we went through Arizona, New Mexico, all the way up the East Coast, and then back across the US through, you know, Ohio. We stopped in Denver for quite a bit, which I think was one of my favorite places. We stayed up on this big mountain that was like, you know, 9,000 feet elevation, and it was this super pretty campsite. And of course, it was like the middle of the week and we were staying there for a week and a half. So it wasn't that busy. We kind of had the place to ourselves. And so I think the highlight for me was just getting to see all of that scenery, and especially the change in scenery. I don't think a lot of people get to experience that many places and that short amount of time. And we also had the benefit of, you know, having hours on the road plus hours in the RV to just talk about the business or work on the business. I often joked to our investors when we were pitching them, when they talked about kind of our co-founder relationship and how we met each other, that if you can survive the first 3 months of your business in an RV with your co-founder, the rest of the road is going to be pretty easy to sort out anything that might happen.
Okay. So at the start of our conversation, you called yourself a student of design, and you've talked about how you like to create things and how you like to, I guess, break things down and see things really in the bits and atoms side of things. In terms of startups and entrepreneurship, how do you draw that parallel?
Yeah, I think the, you know, something that I've realized, especially when starting Avinify, is how much I think the experience matters to the customer. And it's not just about, you know, how it looks, but also how it feels, you know, whether it's encouraging messages throughout a long application process, or whether it's just creating moments of kind of joy and delight in this process that typically just feels like paperwork. We realized the power that that could have on our students at Eventify. And I think the more that I've worked with startups and thought about how I felt about previous things that I built, even though I didn't know it at the time, I think I realized how important that was to me and how much priority I placed on that. And so when I think about kind of the design piece of startups, it's really just about, you know, how you make that feel to the customers, which I think is especially important where, you know, now I'm working in an industry that is pretty much run by these legacy incumbents and people are used to a certain way of doing things. And it's also a very crowded industry, finance being, you know, you have plenty of options for bank accounts, you have plenty of options for investment accounts. And I think one of those ways that you can differentiate yourself is really just by having that better experience for your members and really going to show that you actually care about them and you're building an empathetic product that serves them and doesn't just serve kind of your balance sheet or your profit motives.
That's really interesting. How do you think your recent interest for architecture and design in that realm has influenced the way you look at product or the way you look at tech recently?
I think that when I look at houses now or you know, we'll do virtual tours of houses or even just learn about the ways architects laid those out, I think I find myself kind of putting myself in that homeowner shoes or the architect shoes, thinking about kind of the flow of the building or what purpose that building is trying to do, you know, whether it's an entertainment place or whether it's, you know, kind of this place for solitude and reflection. I think not, there are a lot of similarities in that, you know, you're building this thing, you're designing this thing, you have a customer or a client's interest in mind. And a lot of that is the same at a high level as it is, you know, when you compare it to startups, you have that kind of same thinking framework. And especially with where I spend my time, a lot of that thinking revolves around, you know, how you can get design to accomplish that goal. And so I don't think that there's a huge difference in whether you're designing a building or whether you're designing a website. You know, you're still dealing with the idea of space, you're dealing with the idea of constraints, you're dealing with the idea of attention or focus. And the only thing that really changes is kind of the medium of that message or the scale of that message.
You, in our Twitter conversation, you mentioned that you're sketching some like fantasy projects. What does your fantasy home or dream home or property look like? Do you have an idea of that right now?
I have a couple of things, in the work. I think the thing that I often come most back to is this idea of like a friends and family compound of, you know, what does it look like to have, you know, your 10 closest friends or family members live on this, you know, property with you. And are you all in the same building? And then you have other buildings with amenities, or do you all have your own house, or, you know, is it spread out or is it concentrated like a little neighborhood or village? I think it's an interesting trend. I actually, here in Brooklyn, I'm living in a co-living house. So I have like 9 roommates in this suite. Our entire building has like 21 people that live in it. And so, you know, I really like that idea of community and just want to think more and explore more ways in that, and how that actually kind of like manifests itself or how you can do that most effectively.
How far are you in that process?
Right now, I'm just trying to create kind of this mental model or this testing framework or structure to think about, you know, I'll put myself in the place of whatever I'm looking at and go, okay, if I had, you know, 9 friends living in these little tiny houses around the woods, like, how would that work? And it's like, well, obviously nobody wants to spend their day in a tiny house altogether. If you have 9 people and everyone has a tiny house, it's going to be hard for everyone to get together. So, okay, maybe you'd actually need a central house, or maybe you'd actually need a, you know, central place to gather or something. And so just trying to create this framework of, you know, much like design or startups, you know, what it is that I'm trying to accomplish, and does this version of the space accomplish that?
So I think that you, in your Twitter bio, you also mentioned that you're a sailor.
I grew up sailing on lakes in Texas with my dad and my grandfather, and I didn't really appreciate it as much when I was a kid as I do now, just because there was so much involved that kids don't really like doing. You gotta set up the boat or take it down or clean or do whatever, and it's not as enjoyable. But I think now, where I'm focused so much on work, and then I also have these side projects or hobbies that can feel a little bit like work sometimes, like the newsletter. I had to sit down on Monday, and I was like, I'm not leaving this desk until I write this newsletter. And so sometimes, when they don't necessarily feel like hobbies, there's a really big chance or tendency to get kind of overwhelmed or burnt out with those things. And so last year, decided that I needed something that was away from my desk, out of my house, away from computers, that I could do that ideally was a little bit of exercise also, or outside. And so decided to go and get my actual sailing certification, ended up joining one of the sailing clubs here in New York. And it was really great. I think it's really, there's something really meditative about just being on the water and being in control of the boat, and great excuse to get outside. And of course, awesome opportunity to meet new people too through the club. So I did that during the sailing season last year, counting down the days until the sailing season is back this year.
Nice. You use a lot of words like meditative and like getting energy from things. It sounds like you're very in tune with what gives you or gives you energy or takes away your energy. So what are some things that you do to like recharge or recalibrate or for self-care?
I'm certainly trying to get better at the recharging and calibration. I might be in tune with how I'm feeling and what gives me energy or takes it away, but I have not been the best at kind of acting on those insights. And so I think that's one thing that I especially tried to get better at last year, especially during probably, the toughest year that we had at the company, just with, everything going on. It was a big year for us. And so I think just right now, I'm just trying to get better at kind of doubling down on those things that work for me, whether it's, realizing that I'm burnt out and just sitting down and reading a book or sketching or going sailing. And I've often found that the things that kind of help me recenter and refocus are more like passive activities like sailing or like sketching that, allow me to just kind of sit and be without having to actually sit and do nothing. I'm awful at sitting and doing nothing. So anything that allows me to kind of reduce or remove that stimulation from Twitter or texting or meetings or managing my calendar, I think has been really healthy for me.
How do you ensure that your hobbies stay as things that give you joy and not something that stress you out?
Yeah, I think I'm a bad person to ask about that, because I think I do let my hobbies stress me out and get away from me. I think especially my dad was one of the first people to point this out, where I came up with this idea for, I forget what it was. I was like, oh, it'd be cool if there was a, some website that enabled you to do this. And he's like, yeah, that would be cool. And then a few minutes later, I sent him a logo I had made, and I was like, oh, I'd call it this, and here would be the logo. And he's like, maybe you should focus on, just making it an actual thing before you go and make a logo for it. And so for my architecture hobby, it's like, you start off just reading about them or looking at photos, and then it's like, oh, what are your plans for this weekend? And you're like, I'm going to design a house. And it's like, all right, why don't you, take it slow. Just, it doesn't have to be, commercialized right this instant. So I think I'm working on getting better at it. I think part of that is appreciating why I do it, whether it's to relax and recharge and get away from business, or whether it's to just kind of do something that I enjoy without the, like profit motive or business motive involved. And I think reminding myself why I'm actually sitting here sketching, or, why I'm here on the water without feeling like I need to, spin up a little sunset sailboat tour business. I think it's important.
So, with your interest in architecture, where do you see that developing? Like, in which direction do you see that going?
Yeah, I was thinking about this this the other week, especially thinking about kind of where I wanted the newsletter to go. And I had a few ideas. There was, you know, one idea that, you know, it could spin into some kind of broader newsletter. Like, you know, if you think about what Morning Brew did to newspapers, you know, I could do for the Architectural Digest of the world and build something that was a little bit more appealing to young people and people like me who are not architects, but interested in the design world and kind of pulling them in. Anything from, you know, just keeping the newsletter all the way to, you know, I was daydreaming about, well, what would it look like if I started an architectural design firm with somebody or, you know, worked with a designer to go and build some of these projects at some point. And I kind of reminded myself that all of those options would be great and would be a lot of fun, but wouldn't really be possible if I didn't have that audience for my newsletter. And so kind of reminded myself that, you know, it doesn't really matter, especially for the hobby, it doesn't really matter what my long-term goal is for this thing that I enjoy doing today, because I think a lot of that will resolve itself in the future or become more clear in the future about where I want to take it or what it could become. And that, you know, if it is just a hobby for me, then, you know, continuing to work on it. And of course, you know, I want to continue building that audience and have it be successful, but that's kind of the only thing that matters. And if you can't do that part, then none of the other stuff will happen anyway.
That's lovely. Keep the tweets coming. It was great to chat, Justin. Thank you so much for taking the time.